Welcome to another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler. My guest on today's podcast is my friend, Dr. Julie Hanks. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Richard.
Will you tell us your full name?
Yeah, Julie D'Azevedo Hanks.
We're really glad to have you. Just as way of introduction, Dr. Hanks has a PhD. She has a PhD in marriage and family therapy. Tell us where you got that from.
From University of Louisiana, Monroe.
Wow, that's a great place to live.
Yeah, I actually did it distance. So
did you?
Yeah, while living here in Salt Lake.
And raising a family.
And
we'll talk about that. Prior to that, you earned a master's of social work in the University of Utah. Mm-hmm. And an undergrad degree also. So it's really good to have you. I became aware of Dr. Hanks when we did a podcast together with the Salt Lake Tribune on Mormon land on Bishop's Interviews. And that was one of the first times we met, but we had been on social media and seeing each other's posts. And I came to understand your great clinical work in a couple of areas that we'd love to discuss on the podcast.
Great.
One of the areas is, and I get messages, I'm sure you get lots of messages, couples that get married in the temple and then their faith event sometimes sort of divide isn't the right word, but they just separate
changes.
A little bit.
Yeah, somebody changes or goes through a faith transition, and it happens quite frequently.
And I know you've been helpful to couples that are navigating that because it's something they didn't know would happen on day one of marriage, and now they're raising kids and they have different feelings about our church. And then I thought it would also be helpful for you, and many of my listeners are either sort of working through their own faith in our church or our local leaders trying to help others. And you have great insights into both of those.
Oh, thank you.
And so I just really glad that you are on the podcast. We opened with prayer and we just pray that a spirit will be here that will be helpful for our listeners to be able to just use the principles that Julie will bring to the table to help us understand and bring us together better and more unified, even in our differences. And it's okay to have differences. It's what principles we can use to keep us together in our differences.
Right.
And Julie's introduce yourself to us as far as your family also, Julie.
Yeah. So I've been married for 30 years. I have four children, ages 12 to 28, and a daughter-in-law and two grandbabies, grandson and granddaughter.
How old are your grandkids?
They are 2.5 and 7 months.
And are they here local so you can see them?
They're across the country, North Carolina.
Wow. We have two kids and they're just moving from D.C. to California, but they're still not here. So we're in the same boat.
California's a little closer.
North Carolina.
Yeah.
And I know you're the owner and executive director of Wasatch Family Therapy. Will you tell us a little bit about your company?
Yeah, sure. In 2002, I started Wasatch Family Therapy as a solo practice, and my idea was just to collect like-minded therapists that I really trusted to see clients that I helped bring in, and to create this clinic and have a place where it's safe for all kinds of people to come. Being in Utah, we see a lot of Mormon families, and I've specialized in working with Mormon women and couples and families for the past 25 years.
And if I'd met you during getting your PhD, is that what you hoped to be doing, owning a clinic and having 13 therapists work for you? Or did that come later?
That dream came during my master's degree.
During your master's degree.
I went back for my PhD not too long ago. I graduated in 2015. So I was practicing with my master's as a licensed clinical social worker. So that's what my license is.
Uh-huh. And do you take clients right now, or do you spend most of your time managing your therapists and your business?
I manage the business. I also do coaching now, so distance coaching online. So just more problem solving and more directive. Doesn't treat mental health issues. But I do a lot of supervision of other therapists, which I really enjoy.
In fact, as far as an agenda for this podcast, let's broaden it to be three things. I'd love to have you just be a voice of women, LDS women, and sort of maybe for men like me and others that are trying to understand a voice of an LDS woman and some of the issues that might be difficult and how we can navigate those. That's kind of maybe you speaking to men. Which
okay,
is better than
me
speaking to men about women's issues. And then we'll talk about mixed faith marriages and talk about helping those that might be in a faith crisis or a faith transition. And maybe those will all kind of bleed together. But
okay.
Talk about, since you meet with so many women and you're a woman in the church, sometimes I've learned that I've got to listen to women to understand how women feel. So just bring voice to a few issues that are sometimes really sensitive for women.
Well, I think one that has actually improved recently is the temple and language there. So that's heading in a good direction, not where I'd like it to be quite yet, but getting there. It's also difficult where the church is the only place where I'm told that I can't do certain things. In my career and everywhere else, I'm allowed to do whatever I choose to do. And so there's...
Are there examples of that in the church where you're told not to be able to do something?
Well, hold the priesthood, pass the sacrament, hold certain callings. I have a 12-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old son, and my son gets to do a lot more baptisms for the dead, actually baptized. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things that that men are able to do that women aren't. And I'm not saying I want to do them all. It's just difficult to be told I can't.
What's the best thing is if I'm, let's say, I'm role-playing now a bishop in a BYU ward, and a sister comes in and just expresses those very same things you expressed. What's a good thing for a local leader or a friend to share in that kind of situation?
Yeah, I really think the best thing to do is listen, because there are no good answers. And to come up with some kind of some comforting response that may or may not be true isn't helpful. So I think just listening and validating and saying that must be really hard.
Does validating how someone feels, does it increase the wedge between them and the church? If there is a little bit of a wedge there, do you think it helps them just be able to be okay?
I think you can never go wrong with validating and empathizing. I think when people feel like someone gets them, that emotion is more tolerable and it helps to kind of regulate it. So I think that empathy and validation is crucial. And there really are no great answers to some of these questions. And so I've had people try to make sense of it for me. And it's, no one has ever said anything that's been comforting or is something that I haven't already thought of that, you know, as a possible answer. So don't give answers that you don't know. Just listen.
I like that. More thoughts on just issues. I'm using the word sensitive for women. I'm not even sure mm-hmm. that's the right vocabulary, because that almost implies that women are overly sensitive about these issues. I don't want to suggest that. These are really deep felt, heartfelt feelings about some of the things in our church that may not sit right with some of our faithful women.
Yeah. I'm saddened by the lack of female representation at General Conference. I think hearing from two women in four meetings is you know, it's really sad. And half of the membership is women, and we need to hear from more women. So that's an issue that's tender and brings up feelings. Trying to think of other ones.
And sometimes I think then, what's our doctrine? Because I heard a talk from Sharon Eubank, interestingly, mm-hmm. that my wife sent me, and it was, she talked about the difference between our doctrine and then our practice. And sometimes there's a gap there. And she used the example of a mission president and a mission president's wife. There's no vocabulary there to describe her equal role. And so when I think of the doctrine, what is the doctrine behind how many women speak at at General Conference? And mm-hmm. there is no doctrine there that I'm aware of.
Right.
It's just a practice.
Right.
That may change over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you bring up another tender issue, is just the lack of vocabulary to even talk about women's priestesshood power.
Wow.
you know, if my husband's a high priest, what does that make me? But we, you know, probably a high priestess, but we could never really say that because there's no language for women's power. Mm-hmm. There's no language, you know, it's mission presence wife. I'm currently the bishop's wife, right? I mean,
do you even have a first name?
Right. I don't. And sometimes
you should at least be the doctor's bishop. You should at least get your
bishop's
your PhD doctor, in there somewhere.
Right. It's the only place where I'm not myself. It's where my value is being attached to my husband, which is really an interesting, which I don't mind sometimes, but because he's had his share of that too, because I've been out in the public eye for a long time. So, but it's just an interesting thing that we don't have labels, names, and language for women's duties, responsibilities, and power.
And sometimes I think of the doctrine of our church, and I can't speak to this because I'm male, is if I really understand Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother and that joint co-creation and that and my personal relationship with both of them and that direct line of communication to both of them, even though we talk more about Heavenly Father, to me that is really powerful doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the practice of implementing that doctrine is the example you're using with conference, and it seems it's harder for me as a man to see that because I don't see it as easily, but it seems like as I'm trying to really listen to women, it seems like I validate how women feel.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, I just beg all men that I know who have authority in the church to just please use Heavenly Parents. Like if you do one thing, just use the term Heavenly Parents when you're talking about God the Father and God the Mother. Because whenever, you know, when you're not talking about Jesus, it's always a couple. And we don't acknowledge that. And so in a way, we don't acknowledge the part of Heavenly Mother that's in all the women around us. And yeah, I think that's an easy fix.
Have you seen a trend as you've been tracking this probably longer than I have where we're talking more about Heavenly Mother?
More, but not enough.
Not enough.
Mm-hmm. In the last conference, there was hardly any. The last October, I believe there was at least a handful. But it kind of goes up and down.
Is there anybody that comes to mind that's from the Corman 15 and above or women leaders that have tried to open that door at times? Or do you feel like it's been kind of an inconsistent... Or do you feel like there's anybody that's closed the door and say, we don't talk about Heavenly Mother?
No, I don't think anybody's closed the door recently.
Okay.
And I don't think anyone's on the forefront of opening it. But I know just kind of here and there, people will use Heavenly Mother.
Yeah.
Or Heavenly Parents, not even Heavenly Mother in conference. It's usually Heavenly Parents.
Yeah. So... other just thoughts on what, you know, speaking to men, and maybe women, you can speak to women, but I've always felt that you're speaking, helping men better understand by bringing voice to women, thoughts that, you know, that I just need to understand better as a male.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to understand that women really have very little institutional power. And kind of trying to imagine what that might feel like. And it's hard to imagine because you have it. You know, because you're male, you have opportunities to influence in ways that I never will, just because I'm a female and you're a male.
How does that make you feel?
I feel really sad about that.
Why do you feel sad?
Because I feel like I have contributions to make and it's limited to a certain sphere.
Now I'm tenderhearted.
Yeah, I feel really sad about it.
Because you feel you could contribute and your voice and your skills and your insights aren't valued or heard.
Right.
Or have a chance to
and not just me, but I feel like women's voices, and I think it's changing with kind of having the Elders Quorum and Relief Society be on par, you know, there's some changes that we're seeing that give women a little bit more voice. But I don't really think men can understand what that's like to really feel like you don't ever get to make a decision. Or, I mean, I don't mean ever, but there's always someone above you who can trump your decision. And you're never the one making a final decision. You get to give input if you're asked, if a male decides to ask you for your input.
Have you been in ward councils where you felt your voice was sought after? Or any church council setting?
I haven't been in a lot of presidencies. I've mostly been a teacher.
But you're a good teacher.
Thank you. I'm teaching Relief Society right now, and I love it. I taught gospel doctrine before that, primary. But I've mostly been a teacher. So I don't have a lot of experience in councils. The little experience that I have, I felt like my voice was valued. But I was very outnumbered.
Yeah. You know, 5 years ago, it probably would have been hard for me just to sort of have this conversation. I think I would have been defensive and felt like you were, I don't know what I would have thought. It would just been uncomfortable for me to hear thoughts about how we can do better. But I've learned to enjoy feelings of feeling uncomfortable because it helps me consider things differently than I've looked before, and it helps me to do better. So, and I've learned to validate how people feel, even if I don't feel the same way. How could I expect everybody to feel the way I do? And I love what you said, validating someone actually helps them versus, you know, and if I don't, it probably just adds to your load and you have to defend how you feel. And what an awful spot to be in to have to defend how you feel and sort of justify to me or anybody else, I just feel this way.
Yeah.
Can you just accept
just
that?
Just accept it, yeah. And I appreciate you even asking because a lot of women have feelings but don't really feel free to express it because it's seen as, you know, complaining or criticizing the church, which is not my intent at all. I'm active temple attending,
you know?
And I have pain about certain things for myself and for other women.
I have a family member who's not as active now, and this family member maybe 20 years ago was uncomfortable about some of the things in the temple and went to a temple presidency member and was not validated on how he felt. This was a male, and it caused him to step away from regular temple attendance.
Mm.
And later, the very things he was concerned about changed. But because of more of the experience, he was not, he didn't feel like going back to the temple. And I think that's just really helpful learning. And now, as you first started this segment with women being uncomfortable with some of the language in the temple, and then that changing, one of the learnings for me is that, you know, if someone's uncomfortable about something in the church, like you are with the number of female conference speakers, I could say, well, that's just the way it is, Julie.
Right.
That's the way it's been revealed.
Oh, I've heard, yeah.
Yeah, tell me some of the lies.
God doesn't care if they're male or female. You know, why do you care about gender? What it's God's message. You know, it's like, I know, and I believe that. And I still want to hear from more women, you know? So yeah, there are so many comebacks, right?
And so then I wonder if we open the end sign in 20 years from now, if we still have printed end signs.
Yeah, we won't.
But. We won't. We'll open something post-conference. And if I just did that, I wonder, you know, this mix of male, female speakers. I have to think it'll change. And then I have to think the people that felt that imbalance needed some work will say, you know, we find, you know, that was valid how I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And so
well, I feel like that about the changes in the temple and then the reversal of the LGBT policy. I feel like I'm right. My gut is right. Like it wasn't how it should have been, you know, it wasn't right. Or it needed to change. And so that really helped me to go, okay, the things that don't resonate with me, there's a good chance that over time those will change.
Now, what if some would say, but you're getting ahead of the leaders of our church, or you don't have personal revelation for the whole church, even if you're uncomfortable, and you shouldn't have these feelings that you might see something in the church that you believe will eventually change. What would, if I said that to mm-hmm. you, why is that not helpful, or what would your thoughts be on that?
Well, I don't claim to be receiving revelation for the whole church. But I make a distinction between general authorities have general authority over the general church, and local leaders have local authority over the local church, and I have personal authority over my personal relationship. And my personal authority can tell me certain things through my relationship with the Spirit and with my heavenly parents. And that's valid.
And that's part of our doctrine, is this personal relationship we each have with our heavenly parents.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's really nobody between that relationship. That's one of the core doctrines of our church that I love.
Yeah, me too.
And so I felt the same way about the policy statements. I never could get a testimony of the policy statements, and it became a fallen domino for me. That's the way I framed it up, as sort of my overall faith. And I have lots of dominoes that are really strong and have deep roots, but that one fell.
Mm-hmm.
And I never saw the fruits of it. I never tried to evangelize people to how I felt, but I wanted permission to feel how I felt.
Right.
And my own stake president did that for me. It was very helpful. He didn't maybe see it the same way, but he didn't compare me to the tares. I tweeted about this. He didn't give me a homework list of conference talks to read to get a testimony of the policy statements. He did give me space to have a fallen domino there. And it was very helpful for me. And we had a sweet exchange, when the policy was reversed. And the whole experience has brought me closer with my stake president, because he let me have space there. And he knew my heart, like your heart, was wanting to do what's right and bring people to Christ and be committed to our church. And I can be committed to our church and have something unsettling for me.
Yeah, I agree. Felt the same way.
Sometimes I hear the word feminist, and it's a triggering word for men. Maybe it is for women. I haven't really polled women.
Yeah, it is for women too.
And so can you talk about that word and what it means? Because I think at times our church leaders have been critical of people that take on that label in our own faith.
To me, it just means you believe that women are of equal value and deserve equal opportunities. And so most people are feminists, but they don't like the label because it's come to mean a lot of different things. Militant feminism, like man-hating, or, there are a lot of different things that have become associated with feminism. But I don't think we need to be afraid of it. And really, it's about women choosing their lives, being free to choose what they choose with their lives. And for so long in history, women haven't been free to choose. It's, you relied on a man. Your identity was associated with a man. You couldn't do certain occupations because they weren't open to women, or certain schools. And now we're in this great time where there are so many opportunities. And so feminism is just allowing women to choose and to have equal opportunities.
Do you feel that's consistent with our doctrine?
I feel it's 100%.
Is it one of the things that keeps you in the church? Do you think our church actually has better foundational doctrine on men and women than other faiths?
Because I think the belief in heavenly parents is foundational in that, right? That God is male and female together.
Mm-hmm. That's what I feel.
Yeah. So their potential is there. I just don't feel like the feminine side has been fleshed out yet. I feel like we have all the language and all the titles and words for the masculine side.
It's interesting. Yeah, I've taken on that label, a feminist,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't quite known what that means. except I'm comfortable because I think it is what you just said, and I think it's consistent with our doctrine. I did a Twitter poll. I do Twitter polls and asked what percent of my Twitter followers are women and take on that label and men. And it was well over 50% for both groups that were active LDS and took on that label. And I was surprised how many men took on that label, to your point.
Yeah. And a lot of men become feminists when they have daughters. There's some kind of, you see the world differently when you have this vulnerable daughter and realize how the world treats men and women differently.
And I've almost sensed men taking on the label feminist is less controversial than women taking on the label feminist.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I picked up on Twitter is the women who take that label on often
get pushed back.
Get pushed back more than the men that take that on. I thought, well, that's not fair. It's
right.
Just back to the unfairness of
right.
Sometimes things.
Right. That's a great point.
Interesting. Any other suggestions to local leaders to value women's voices? So if I'm a bishop or an elders' quorum president or Relief Society president, I guess, you know, or a young men's president, young women's president, I'm actually kind of aware of this issue and I want to do things in my area of influence to create a feeling of equality. Any suggestions?
Yes. I think including the young women any way you can, whether that's handing out programs or that's having them be ministering. I love that they can be ministering sisters now. All those, any opportunity to use the young women and let them know that they're valued in our community, I think is really, really important. I think being aware of the ratio of male to female speakers in sacrament meeting and also who speaks last. There's kind of this tradition that the man with the priesthood is going to bring it home. And I think that sends a message over time. So letting women kind of take that role of, you know, teaching the doctrine.
Teaching the doctrine.
Yeah. You kind of feel like the last talk is
the bring it home doctrine talk.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not always the case. Including women in decision-making whenever possible, I think is really important. Trusting the Relief Society president's decisions, trusting the primary president's decisions, not trying to meddle if you don't need to, you know, let them be as autonomous as possible. I think including, if you're a bishop, including your wife as a partnership in the calling, standing together, speaking together, doing firesides together, you know, modeling partnership, I think is powerful.
It's interesting. I know that as I tried to better understand when we were released as YSA bishop, and I don't even know what to call my wife.
I know.
I just use plural. We were released as YSA bishop, which is not grammatically correct. We gave a joint talk. We both went up to the podium together and actually both spoke together as we kind of interacted. It wasn't just her speaking and then me, as we interacted a little bit together. And I don't know where I picked that up and I don't do everything right, but I like the visual for our YSAs of us speaking together as we were released from our YSA assignment.
Yeah. I think also calling the primary president and the young women's president and the Relief Society president.
Is there anything in our handbook that would prevent that?
I don't have access to the handbook, so that's another discussion.
That's a good answer. That was a trick question to see if you're, while your husband's asleep, you're going over and looking at his handbook.
Yeah, really.
So I think that's a great thing to call people by their titles. We're calling the men by the title, so the women by the title.
Mm-hmm.
Other thoughts?
Wow. It's, you know, I'm really touched. It's so rare that a man wants to sit down and listen.
So
I'm just having a moment here.
Well.
And not try to explain or justify. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And, you know, I've shared this on the podcast before, but during my YSA assignment, my emotional gas tank got so low that I need a therapist. Mm-hmm. And I brought a therapist in my life, and she is a she,
mm-hmm.
And she helped me. But then one of the unique things that happened as we met every week is I would then start to bring YSA situations to her without any name.
Mm-hmm.
And she had, and I would do the same thing with my counselors and without a name and say, yeah, this is somebody, as we counsel together. And she had, because of her clinical training, incredible insights.
Mm.
And taught me things about what I could do to help people. She taught me the iceberg concept, that often what you see above the iceberg is the bad behavior. You got to put that on the shelf and kind of dig down.
Yeah.
But it's in an informal way, it's like she became part of our bishopric, our council. I don't want to get too radical there, listeners. Yeah. And she was not set apart as a member of our bishopric. And it
but
was
you
very,
let her influence you.
Yes. That's... And I needed her counsel and her insight because it helped me help the YSAs.
Yeah.
And I wish I had that kind of training from her before I served and earlier in my life, because she just taught me, you know, I learned great administrative skills from a lot of my priesthood leaders, but some of the skills that she taught me, and I guess men could teach me those too, that have that kind of training.
Yeah.
It was just a beautiful experience for me. And she helped so many lives in our YSA ward that they will never, they think I did it or the Lord working through me, but it was the Lord working through both of us. And it was a very, so I've wondered, you know, in councils, I've wondered the skill set you have and how important that is in a pastoral role for local leaders to help their YSAs. Any thoughts on that, how we can better leverage this, that skill set into, you know, counseling with people?
I think just in inviting therapist to speak, like Fifth Sunday kinds of things, or firesides, or I love that you went to a therapist yourself. I feel like that's, those skills are so, just so basic and so important in human interactions. So I love that you did that. I think my specific skill set has been underutilized in my area, you know, in the areas where I've lived. I feel like
as far as the church, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, it's really honest to say that. Thanks for saying that.
Yeah, sure.
It takes courage to kind of say that.
I feel like I have a lot more to offer than I have been invited to.
Been invited to.
Yeah. Although I have done a lot of speaking to women's groups, which I have loved.
That's great.
Yeah.
Do you ever speak to men's groups?
I speak to couples.
Have you ever gone to a YSA bishop training meeting and asked to speak to all the
I've never been invited.
Well, and I don't want to be critical, but I would, you know, that's the kind of, I hope that that happens for you. I hope that you're speaking to men.
Well, I was just invited, a friend of mine is a bishop, and he invited me to come, and we just did a Q&A with couples in their ward.
Wow.
And talked about women in the church and how men can support women and
good
communication skills. And we covered a lot, parenting, and it was really great.
So I got a call like you get. I get messages on social media or email, and people can find me. And it was a person in a marriage where, you know, this person was very traditional believing and this person's spouse was not, and they have young kids at home, and this person could kind of handle that their spouse was less traditional believing. But the real tension was their joint influence that was not on the same page to their kids.
Mm.
And so just talk to us about that space. If, you know, if you're talk first to the parent who's the traditional believing one that's got, you know, a spouse that's not traditional believing and was, and now that spouse is kind of talking to the kids.
Yeah. So there's a concept that I think is really important here called differentiation of self. And that is the ability to be an individual and in connection with other people. And so that tension between individual and relationship, we all have to navigate that. And as couples and as human beings grow and continue to develop, they differentiate more and more. And it could be a changes with faith, or it could be changes with parenting, or it could be, you know, sexual differences, or I mean, it could be a myriad of things. But since we're talking about faith differences, that can be a way of differentiation of self. So saying I'm me and I'm in relationship with you. And so often we think marriage means being the same, and often in early marriage it does. But if people continue to grow, it means developing differences. And so First I would say just to normalize that, like that's a normal growth process.
So this isn't a setback in a marriage. This is a normal, right, non-shaming, positive thing.
And it will happen if you're growing, no matter what. It may be just a different topic that sparks it. Mm-hmm. So to not look at it like this is the end of the world, look at it like this is potential for growth, to continue to differentiate and remain in connection with each other. And it's really a great way to model differentiation in family life. If two parents can be on different pages with their faith and still love each other and still, you know, have a great connection and still raise kids together, that what that models for kids is that they can grow up and be themselves. They don't have to be mini-me's of the parents, that they can develop and grow and differentiate. And so it really creates a cool opportunity for the whole family, even though it doesn't feel like that. It feels like, you know, it's a crisis. And the definition of crisis is a dangerous opportunity.
Wow.
And so I think
that's
actually really accurate in this situation.
That's all positive you said there.
So I wanted to frame it that way first.
There's
and then
no
go
shaming.
Into the, right. To normalize it, because it's really a normal part of development. Now, does it mean it's easy? No, it's not easy at all. And there's a researcher and psychologist named David Snarch, say that 10 times. But he came up with these 4 points in differentiation that I wanted to share with you, because I think they're just really great for mental health in general. But the first one is to have a solid, flexible self. So you have a set of core values, but you're able to be flexible. But you're not changeable, right? And the second is a quiet mind and calm heart. So that's being able to soothe your own anxieties, to be able to calm yourself down and not have to rely on others to soothe you all the time. Then the third is grounded responding. That's being able to modulate your responses in interpersonal situations. So you can turn up the volume or turn down the volume depending on the situation, and you don't overreact and you don't underreact. And then the fourth is meaningful endurance. And that is the ability to tolerate discomfort for growth.
Wow.
And I think that gets to the heart of this differentiation. And when you're on a different page with faith, you have to tolerate discomfort for growth. You don't have to, but you don't just want to tolerate the discomfort. You want to tolerate it for the growth.
So I love the way all those steps are positive and give a framework. How about the kids? So what if what if I'm the husband and my wife is in a different spot with the faith, or even lost, you know, faith in the faith, and mm-hmm. isn't going to church and feels it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I've got these kids that are under 16 at home. And mm-hmm. what principles apply to keep our family together? Or is the default position that we ought to teach the kids the faith that we started in? And if I'm the wife, I ought to not be doing things to expose the kids to the feelings I feel? Or how do you?
Yeah.
And maybe there's not one right answer for every family, but I'm sure you've had lots of conversations.
Oh, yes. And I just did a workshop with John DeLynn last weekend, or mixed faith marriage retreat, a 2-day retreat. And so this is just fresh on my mind. But I'll borrow something from John that he says. He says, it's really good to say, Dad believes this, Mom believes this. What do you believe? And to help the kids develop their own sense of self and their own set of beliefs. Now, if they're, you know, 3, I mean, they're just going to do whatever you tell them to do. But starting a dialogue that's open like that, kids can handle parents being on different pages.
That seems really scary for mm-hmm. me if I'm the traditional believing LDS parent and I don't want my kids to be exposed to anything that could cause them to lose faith. It seems like I would want to say, well, let's don't have that discussion until they're 18 or 20, or let's them figure that on their own.
Yeah. And you can do that. And I'm not saying you should tell them, you know, make them read the CES letter when they're 12 or, you know, but, you know, you, it could be just simple and dependent on what developmental stage they're in. And so it could just be, you know, daddy doesn't believe that the church is true and mommy does, or daddy doesn't believe that in Joseph Smith was a prophet and mommy does. What do you believe? What feels right to you?
What's the age you'd have that discussion with your kids? Is there any general idea? You said three is too young.
Yeah. I mean, I think you could start at 5, 6, 7, just helping, and not just around faith things, just around everything, right? You can ask them, what was that like for you? Or what do you think? I'll ask my kids, you know, how did you feel about that test? What did that, you know, or how did that situation feel? Or how did that conversation go for you? Helping them to develop their own voice and their own values. And it is terrifying because we want our kids to be just like us. And the chances are that they're going to be just like us are not very good. Either way, like they're going to become who they are, right?
I know my wife and I are, you know, we're in the same boat with the church, but politically we're quite a bit different. And
yeah.
We've sort of, I think we've tried to do what you've said and not try to, we've been upfront that we're different politically, and we've tried not to draw our kids one way or the other. And so we've kind of, and we've actually thought it might help our kids to have parents that are unified in family values and the family and have differences. And it might give our kids some framework if there's differences in their own relationships. That's the only experience we have in that space.
Yeah. And kids can handle those differences, right? But, I just lost my train of thought. It was really good.
I know. It's been, and it may come back.
Okay.
So if I'm visiting with you individually, and I'm the believing spouse, and I've got a spouse that I really feel is hurting my kid's faith, and that spouse has found things about the church that has caused him or her to lose their faith. And they just, sometimes I meet people that when they learn that stuff, they want to tell everybody else that stuff.
Right.
It might be a natural human emotion. Well, so
what happens, they become missionaries for the other side, right? They become the thing that they are trying to leave. It's two sides of the same coin.
So what would you tell me if I've got a spouse that I feel is really hurting my kid's faith and it's now affecting my feelings about my spouse?
Yeah, I would say to express your, so there's secondary emotions and primary emotions. So secondary emotions are what is easily seen, what's above. I use the ocean analogy. So you don't really see a lot of life above the ocean, but the life is underneath. It's like your iceberg. So what's underneath is usually more vulnerable. So anger, irritability, resentment, that's all secondary. But primary is usually sad, scared, lonely, you know, afraid, those just softer, more tender emotions. So I would express those tender emotions and say, you know, I'm really sad that you're continuing to talk to our kids about this stuff. I don't feel like it's helpful on their journey. And I respect your journey, but I don't want you to make your journey their journey because they need to have their own. Will you, you know, it would mean a lot to me if you would talk to me and we could agree on what you could share with them or whatever, you know, agreement you want to make. But I don't think there's a right way to do it. But it never hurts to share vulnerable emotions.
That's really powerful.
People respond empathetically, usually.
That's really powerful. I love that. There's just a good spirit as you said that.
Thanks.
There's a side of me that wants to default to the believing parent for these kids, that if you started out with both of you believing and sort of that was the deal you made when you got married, and if you got married in the temple and then one loses their faith, there's a side of me, and I don't know why, that would say I would, as a default, want to bring the kids up in the faith and mm-hmm. let them at an appropriate age, which I would put kind of senior at high school or post-mission or somewhere in there, you know, maybe as they're starting to find their own way, that I wouldn't, as the non-believing parent, want to, you know, cause that to happen earlier than they may initiate themselves. And some kids may never initiate it. They may just stay fully believing. And some kids might go through a doubting stage where they connect more with the parent that stepped away. I don't know if that's fair.
Yeah, I don't know if that's
probably what I would, if I were a homeward bishop and someone were in my office, I'd probably invite the non-believing spouse to say, you know, I think, you know, if you can, I would encourage you not to do anything to destroy faith in your kids, and let them, if they start asking questions at some point, but to start to generate doubt or questions. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah. And I think the non-believing parent can be authentic without giving all the details, right? Just saying, I don't believe anymore. I lost my testimony is one thing, but giving, well, you know, have you read about, you know, you read the essays and have you read this? And that's different. I wouldn't necessarily default to, I just don't think that's not fair, but both parents, they're equal parents.
They're equal parents.
Right? And, you know, I have a lot of empathy for the parent who's left the church, because a few people in the workshop over the weekend voiced, you know, how could I encourage my kids to go to a church that says I'm dangerous, that, you know, I'm an apostate, that I'm like, why would I send my kids to a church that treats LGBT people as less? Why would I, you know, I mean, there's some really good
valid
points. And so there's this compromise that needs to happen, right? So it might be that they're required until they're 16 to go just to, at least to sacrament meeting, or, I mean, you have to do that compromise, or the kids can go to church, but they also have to go to another church every other Sunday. Or, I mean, they're all different. You have to get creative. It's not just A or B. There's C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J. You have to get really creative in navigating these situations.
And I would guess it comes back to core family principles, like we have a goal to keep our family together. Mm-hmm. We have a goal to keep our marriage together. We want to keep the family circle together. We want to create a spirit of open communication and love and honesty. So I would guess if you could give them those sort of common ground principles that we all agree on, that are
the family values,
the
right?
Family
not necessarily behaviors or goals,
but values.
But like what are we striving for as human beings?
What's an example of a family value, Dr. Hanks?
Integrity.
Integrity.
Fun. Adventure. Peace. Hopefulness. Connection. Empathy. Spirituality, which is different from religiosity, right? It was interesting, in a previous workshop, a couple, mixed faith couple, the non-believing spouse put spirituality and the believing spouse didn't put that on their values list, which was really great, because the believing spouse was like, oh, that's important to you? Like, oh yeah, you know.
A relationship with God.
Yeah. So identifying what those values are and what you have in common is really important. And John talked a lot about values in our mixed faith marriage retreat, and how important that is.
I love that. To me is doable. So if I were, I'm kind of coming back to pretending I'm counseling a couple. I'm not a resident ward bishop, but I sometimes think resident ward bishops are in this space where they're trying to provide clinical skill the best they can in a situation like this. But I love the idea of bringing it back to the family values. And I might give a couple a homework assignment first to, if they can't get to someone like you, is to make a list of values. And what a instead of all the things that could pull a couple apart to work on that, everything you said, I love all those words you said, integrity, empathy, and then talk about how this space fits in within those values. To me, mm-hmm. is a really productive exercise.
Mm-hmm. And I think you can also navigate those differences by having, you know, having the kids still go to church and then having kind of a debrief afterward. Like, so what did you learn? How did you feel about that? You know, because I mean, I'm active and I still feel the need to debrief my kids after, like, okay, like, is there anything I need to undo? Right? Like certain
does
primary
your husband
songs.
Get nervous about that?
Yeah. But there's just a difference, you know.
But you have core values that keep your family together.
Right, right. I mean, we're solid, and but there are some things like certain primary songs where, you know, where and like the proclamation is really clear on gender roles, and I'm a lot more flexible, and in our marriage we're really flexible. Mm-hmm. And so we whenever there's gender roles taught, I'm always like, and you know that mom's can moms provide all the time too, and dads nurture, and you know, kind of have to like undo that script that they're being taught, because I don't necessarily think it's
I like that
true.
I like that. I like my wife and I got married, and we just assumed these roles, but they were very much just what we saw in our own families.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the way that we and my some of my kids I see revisiting those and saying, "Well, wait a second, you know,"
yeah,
in a very thoughtful way.
Yeah, it's been, that's a whole other conversation, gender roles and Mormonism.
So another topic is, and I we mentioned this before we started, is I did a Twitter poll of, because I have a younger group on my Twitter feed, and I said, so those of you that hold a temple recommend and are in a faith crisis, is your goal to find a way to stay in our church or a way to leave? And 88%, and I think, I can't remember the respondents, it was 300 or 1,100, said, I'd like to find a way to stay. And one of your, I think, skills is helping people sort of navigate faith crisis. So if I'm coming to you, and I know you've had these conversations, and I'm saying, Julie, I just don't believe anymore. I don't know how to reconcile this. There's parts of our church I still really believe in, but parts that I don't believe in, or I don't understand. What do you say to people that, and they may say, Julie, my goal is to find a way to stay. I want to authentically stay. It's one thing just to stay and sit in the pews and say, I don't believe.
Yeah.
It's another thing to say, I sit in the pews and actually can authentically believe.
Yeah. Well, I would say I would normalize that process. Like that's okay. And you can be in that space and stay, and you can sort through things, and you can believe some things and not believe others. Because that's where I am. There are certain things I'm like, with the church. I mean, I believe the core doctrine of Jesus Christ, and that's what I would advise people. Like, do you believe in the core doctrine, faith, repentance, baptism, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Loving your neighbor, loving God, loving your neighbor as yourself. Do you believe that? Because that's the gospel. And then there's the church that's an imperfect vehicle for imperfect people to try and return back. And so for you to see all the imperfections in the church is totally normal, and they're there. and it's okay to not believe, you know, the way everything's implemented, because you don't have to. You have to believe in the core doctrine of Christ.
I love that. I love that. And I think of analogies, and the analogy that came to my mind on one of my morning walks was like an island in the ocean represents my relationship with Christ, and I want to do everything I can to get to that island, and the covenants I keep are part of it, and the teachings of the church. But I sometimes think the current, this goes back to the ocean,
mm-hmm.
the current under the water is our church, and it generally moves me towards the island. And it's
that.
The fuel, and it kind of is moving there. But sometimes you can get in a current that you feel, you know, you feel the current actually moves you in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from our church. And so sometimes I think of models to kind of frame up exactly what you said. And to me, that's the limitations of our institutional church, or a personal leader, or a council meeting that kind of went sideways, or
yeah.
somebody said in church. And And the current doesn't help me come into Christ, and it makes it a little harder. And so sometimes I have to think, well, that's where the church is. It's not the church doesn't necessarily represent the island. The island is still Christ and my relationship with Christ.
Right, right.
So I don't know if those sort of models help. And
That helps a lot. I think that's a really great analogy.
But I love what you said. You gave permission for people to be uncomfortable with part. And I don't know if we've normalized that.
Yeah. And like saying, I know this church is true. The gospel of Jesus Christ is true. Like, the church isn't always true. Like, it's not always on target. But that's okay. That's part of the human experience. And I think the church is in a developmental process as a system, just like families are in developmental processes and individuals are in developmental processes. And the church is growing and learning and making mistakes and trying to, you know, figure out the best course of action. And I think the church works a lot like we do. I mean, you know, we just get a feeling like, I think we should go this direction. It feels like the Spirit's teaching me this. Oh, you know what? Look, that's not right. Let's try this direction, you know, and just kind of feeling our way through and trying to listen to the Spirit the best we can. And I feel like the church is in that same process.
Oh, I like that. What kind of culture do you create in your Relief Society lessons and when you were a gospel doctrine teacher to try to create space for different feelings or just people to come as you are? And I may not have an I know the church is true testimony and the best answer. What do you do as a teacher to try to know that there's people in different spaces within your voice?
Well, what I try to do is be vulnerable myself and share my own parts of my own journey, parts of my family journey, parts of my faith journey. Like, I've been really open in my Relief Society class about the LGBTQ policy and how upsetting it was. I haven't taught since it's been changed, but
how did that go over?
It made some people really nervous, I think. And I talked about my siblings, most of my siblings leaving the church or my daughter leaving the church. And I've talked about that we've had marriage problems and
that's
that,
really,
you know,
honest.
So I try to model
that. It takes that. Courage to be real.
Try to model that. And I think I also try to ask really good questions, not just the ones where, you know, Sunday school answers, but like really, really, what does this mean to you? Or really, what does this look like in your life? So that's how I try to.
I love that. Do you find then people are vulnerable back either in class or in the hallway with you after or even on a walk later on?
Yeah. Yeah. I found that they are. And I think people want to be. There just hasn't been the climate created at church or that kind of culture where that's okay, you know, where we can take off the perfectionism and the masks and kind of be real people.
And then sometimes I go to voices in our scriptures, leaders in our scriptures, and Nephi always gets on my radar map in 2 Nephi, where he kind of goes vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, he talks about these sins that do easily beseech me in the valley of, I can't remember. And and it's one of the things I think as I'm learning more about vulnerability that I love about Nephi is that he just did that.
Yeah.
And it connected me with more Nephi. I love that Elder Holland went vulnerable with a broken vessel.
I was sobbing because I just thought of all my clients who will just feel so validated and feel like they don't have to hide their mental illness. And
wow.
That, I mean, I just was like, oh my gosh, this is a landmark.
This would do for other people.
Yeah, landmark talk. I just knew what it would mean. And yeah, and it has. It's quoted all the time, right? When people talk about mental illness. So that was a huge risk for him.
It's a huge risk.
And it made a difference for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think we connect with Elder Holland. And
yeah.
I hope we can do more of that. I wasn't very vulnerable as a YSA bishop. I didn't know how to do that. I was seeing a therapist for a whole year. Didn't tell any of the YSAs, didn't tell the pulpit. I didn't start meeting.
My shrink said.
Sorry I can't meet with you Tuesday night. I'm meeting with my therapist.
And right. I'm pretty open about
I think I would have do that now. I think I would have you know, I think I've learned, I don't feel any shame for seeing a therapist.
Yeah.
I don't feel like, you know, I did anything wrong. There was no spiritual malady going on there.
Right.
To cause me to want to see a therapist. And you even said sometimes our marriage is difficult.
Yeah.
And you said that. And I think, you know, I don't think that means your marriage is going to not work because you just said that out loud. I think it's more likely to work. And I think you create space for other people,
right,
that want to talk about maybe not that issue, but maybe that issue as well as any other issue.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as people create that climate of being more vulnerable and saying, yeah, I go to therapy. And I mean, me personally, I've gone on and off since I was 14. That was
cool.
My first foray into therapy. And I just thought, wow, this is life-changing stuff. This is really cool. Maybe I'll do this when I grow up.
That's cool.
Yeah. And, you know, I've gone on and off. And I just think the more people talk about therapy and mental illness and just normalize and faith crises and just kind of normalize it as, yeah, this is part of the human experience. And it doesn't mean you're bad or wrong or flawed.
Do you feel like our younger members want to be vulnerable and want to have those kind of conversations more than my age group?
Yeah, I think they're already having them a lot more.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I read this quote a lot of podcasts. Jake Watts sent me this. It's out of the book called The Wounded Healer by Henry Norwin. Mm. And a minister's service, and this is who you are, Julie, will not be perceived as authentic unless it comes from a heart wounded about the suffering about which he speaks. The great illusion of leadership is to think others can be led out of the desert by someone who's never been there.
Mm.
And so you're the wounded healer. You know, when you talk of that, you went to therapy and now you're a therapist. And
yeah.
So you know that desert enough, I think, to be able to have a firsthand experience plus great education and clinical experience to lead people out of the desert.
Thank
and it's
you.
A great
I
gift.
Love that.
And I just love that. And Christ is the ultimate wounded healer.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he hasn't walked like some of us have, he's felt everything.
Right.
And I think we're all more wounded than I thought we were.
Oh, and that's one of the gifts of being a therapist.
I thought everybody but me was wounded. Wait a second. Did I say that backwards? I do that sometimes.
You thought you were the only one that was wounded?
Yeah. And then I realized we're all kind of wounded.
We're all very wounded. That's just part of the experience. And that's how we grow.
It's how we grow.
Yeah. It's part of the plan. It's part of the plan. And once I realized that, I was like, oh, it's okay. I'm fine. You know, I'm just growing. That's okay.
And even in these marriages where there's difference in faith,
mm-hmm.
we can say we're fine, we're growing, we have the same values.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is really hard. And this
really
is going to like stretch us beyond what we can do. And not all marriages can survive it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen a lot of marriages that have. And who have actually benefited and become closer because they've differentiated and been able to create intimacy as two really separate people choosing to come together and create, you know, continue to create love and a happy family.
Talk about why you stay. Because sometimes it's really helpful for my listeners listening to someone who they sense really understands all the complicated, messy stuff. And is not going to be surprised with something that comes out next week because you kind of know
right.
all that stuff.
Right.
I assume it's not very likely you're going to get surprised with
right.
a new fact from church history.
Right. I don't think so.
And so you are someone that is in.
I'm in.
And why?
This is my spiritual path. This is the path that I choose. And this is where I feel like my heavenly parents want me to be. And that's really the simplicity of it. This is a choice that I've made, and this is the spiritual path I was born into, and feel like it's the one for me to bring me to Christ. And my life, the good things in my life, so much of it has come from being a member of the Church of Jesus Christ. And I appreciate that and love that and can see good fruits from trying to live the gospel.
Is it easier to stay? And do you feel
I don't think it's easy to stay, and I don't think it's easy to leave. I think they're both really, really hard decisions that very few people take lightly.
I read something, I'm having a flashback. One of the very first things I read from you was the things not to say to someone that leaves. Do you remember any of those from your list?
Yeah, I also did a list of what not to say to believing loved ones. So what not to say from someone who leaves. Let's see. I'm praying for you. Have you read your scriptures? Have you been saying your prayers? I'll visit you. I'll come down and visit you from the celestial kingdom. You have a dark spirit about you. I think you're under the influence of Satan. You know, all those gems that people have said to other people. If you just had enough faith, I know you believe. I know you deep down you believe. So those are some that
really good.
Come to mind.
They're really good. And give us the other list, what you can remember.
So I did two lists for each. So I did then what to say to someone who's left the church. Just say, I trust you. I love you.
I trust you.
Mm-hmm. I trust you. I love you. I think those are the two biggest ones. There were 25 though, and I can't remember them now.
It's getting late at night.
Trust you. I love you.
I trust you.
I honor your path. Just respectful things, right? And that's on both lists. So what not to say to someone who's a believing member would be take your blinders off. Oh, you believe in all these logical fallacies. Why don't you read the CES letter? Have you heard of the Kinderhook plates? Just bringing up all the church history stuff.
And sort of simplifying their faith, their intellectual ability by the blinders off is sort of a put down that you don't have intellectual, if you're really smart intellectually, that you would not believe.
Right. Putting down intelligence, like you're smarter than this. You're smarter than this. Don't you see it?
One of the things you said on your list, I believe it was you, was to thank people that had left for all the good that they've done. And I thought that was so insightful because a lot of the people that leave have really given, this is your wording, I believe, decades to the church.
I don't remember this, so maybe it is, maybe it isn't.
And I thought, you know, it's really true because if someone leaves after decades, they've given so much to the church.
Their life.
And so instead of saying you have a dark spirit, I've thought that makes sense to just thank them for what they've done.
Yeah.
And be really sincere about it.
And I respect your integrity is another one.
Respect your integrity.
Because people who leave, it's because that's what they...
It's their integrity.
They are trying to keep their integrity.
And I've kind of divided the temple recommend questions in my mind to belief questions and behavior questions.
Mm.
And I've thought, the more I think about this, I have more empathy for belief questions because I think it's harder to control those than behavior questions. So when I think of the covenant path, I've met people from a behavior standpoint that are on the covenant path. You know, they're living all the rules and believe in all the rules. Sometimes it's just hard to believe.
Yeah.
And I've thought how to provide space for them as they, and most that want to believe in all the things that are required of the church. So.
Yeah. And I think a hope is good enough to, you know, there are a lot of things I hope. I can't even say I believe or I know. There's very few things I can say that I know. But there are lots of things I believe and lots of things I hope for that I hope are true, you know.
I love
and
that.
That's okay.
Hope is a great word.
Yeah. And you don't have to know you don't have to be certain. Being comfortable with uncertainty is something that the last several years I've been working on. It's like, it's okay to not know. Because the more I learn, the more I realize how little I know.
And here you are with a PhD and you're increasingly comfortable with uncertainty.
Yes.
And I don't think that's falling backwards. I think that's falling forwards and part of just great faith and great understanding. I really like that.
Thanks.
And I'm trying to move in that direction. I think it's a great spot to be in. It doesn't mean that I'm a perpetual doubter. It doesn't mean I have hope.
Right. But uncertainty is okay. We don't have to be certain about everything. And uncertainty isn't bad.
I really like that. I've shared this story before, but maybe people are listening just to this podcast. But we were at Trek this summer at Martin's Cove with mm-hmm. the youth, and we were in Dan's Cove, and I had a really good spiritual experience. And then we're going to walk up to Martin's Cove. I don't know if you've done that, Julie. Have you ever walked up to Martin's Cove? But you can't really stay up there. It's kind of a 30-minute walk and down. But the senior couple said something really interesting to the youth as they were leaving. He says, some of you are going to have a really good spiritual experience there. But then he said, some of you won't feel the Spirit. And I thought, and I talked to him after, and I said, why did you say that? And he goes, because some won't. And then they'll come back to the testimony meeting at the end of youth conference, and everybody will talk about the incredible experience they had up top of Martin's Cove. And a certain group of those kids are going to be sitting there, I didn't feel anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to feel like they don't belong
because
they don't have the same type of spiritual experiences. And I love the principle he taught there is that we all are going to have different spiritual experiences and different levels of belief. And I don't think I should, as a parent, require my kid or someone in my ward to go from I hope the church is true testimony to an I believe. I'm not sure that, just like you say, I'm not sure that is something that I can control in myself. I don't know if you got any thoughts on that.
I love what you're saying. I don't know that I have anything to add.
So I think we're both kind of on the same page of trying to create. We just have different spiritual gifts.
And
I think as we're all trying to move to that island of coming under Christ. And for some of us, we're just all kind of in different currents and processing moving to that island differently. And that shouldn't even be a race. And we shouldn't even be measuring if people are ahead of us or behind us, because it's impossible to tell.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that analogy. That's great.
Well, these are the things I think about in the morning.
On your walk.
On my walk. I used to run, but that was 40 pounds ago. I've got to figure out. I need to find a new therapist that can get me to eat right again. So now I'm being vulnerable on my podcast about my lack of discipline in eating for the last few years. Do you have any other thoughts that are just on your mind, Julie, you'd love to share with our listeners?
I have one other thing I wanted to add to the question, why I stay.
Okay.
I stay because I've had profound spiritual experiences that I can't deny, and I don't want to deny, and that I hold very sacred. And what I can say is I know that I have heavenly parents, and they've both answered prayers. And I feel like, you know, this is where they want me to be. And I treasure those experiences, and they've been anchors in my life.
Do you keep having those experiences? Do they come unexpectedly? Do they come when you think they might come?
I don't know if it's a spiritual gift or what, but I get very specific answers to certain prayers, like very specific guidance in a very specific way. And I've noticed a pattern through the years, and I'm so grateful. Because whenever I heed the guidance, my life is blessed.
How did you decide to do a career? Because, you know, I assume when you were going to undergrad and not many women were talking about getting PhDs and owning a clinical practice and the things you're doing, which are just awesome.
Is this another podcast? I don't know if this... You want me to go into it?
I think it's helpful for our younger listeners that may be thinking, I can do this. Maybe I can get a PhD. And are there other women that are ahead of me that have blazed this trail? And maybe it's not a PhD trail, but it's a trail that is a little less orthodox in our faith or a little less traditional, but certainly within our doctrine. And we're actually leveraging our doctrine.
Yeah, yeah. So I grew up with a mom my mom was raising 9 kids.
Wow.
And she's an amazing woman. And as a young woman, I looked at her life and thought, it's good for her, but it's not for me. But I don't know. I, I don't know another way. Like, is there another way? I sensed that she had abandoned her own development for the sake of the family, which I'm so grateful for. And I didn't want to do that. And so I've been on this quest. Like, is it possible for an active LDS woman to have a functional, loving, fulfilling family life and have a thriving, exciting personal life and professional life and creative life? And like, is that asking too much, you know? So that's kind of been my quest. And I haven't...
Where were you raised?
I was raised in Southern California.
Okay.
And then I spent a couple of years at BYU before I transferred to the U. But this was during the To the Mothers in Zion era of Ezra Taft Benson, really hitting home, like women not working. And I had already been in therapy and felt like I had developed a sense of self kind of beyond most of my peers by my late teens.
Cool.
And I think that's what actually helped me have the the tenacity to advocate for myself within my family life. So I got married.
What a wonderful phrase, advocate for myself.
So, well, that's what I feel like I've had to do, because families are not set up to support the woman's career.
What a cool thing to advocate for yourself.
Thank you.
I hope all our listeners advocate for themselves. That's really cool.
Thanks.
And the tenacity to do that.
Thanks. I got married at 20, had my first baby at 21. I was in school. And I also was like, I'm going to finish school and I actually want to get a master's. And it wasn't, can I do this? It was, how are we going to do this? It wasn't an option. And so that's kind of what I mean by advocating for myself and just constantly questioning the default mode. Like, now, why is it my job to write 500 thank you notes?
Questioning the default mode.
Like, after we got married, 500 thank you.
Yeah.
I'm like, here's your 250. I'll do 250. And
whose penmanship is better?
Mine.
Okay.
Much better. And I'm like, I'll send your mom your way when her friends start calling because you didn't send thank you notes. But I'm doing 250. That's not fair. We're both in school and working two jobs. And you
How did your husband respond?
He didn't do them. But I didn't do them either. You know? And we've been negotiating ever since. And we've figured out how to be really fluid in our family life. He's directly cared for the kids. I was touring a lot during this time when I was in school and having babies, and
this
I was
is
doing
a beautiful
music.
Story.
And I mean, it was hard and stressful, and we had a lot of tension, and you know, it wasn't what he expected, and it wasn't what I expected, and we didn't know what we were doing, but I just felt like I have to advocate for myself within this structure, within this religion, within the family setup, and not, I really felt certain callings, like, God wants me to do certain things, and it's not if, it's like, how are we going to figure this out? And I matter just as much as my husband and kids. So we're going to all work together to figure this out. And a few years ago, my then 22-year-old daughter, we were just talking, and she casually said, Mom, you know what I realized? I'm the only person I know who has a mom they want to be like when they grow up.
Wow.
And I just burst into tears because I was like,
what a compliment.
That was my whole goal, is like to model a life where my daughters were excited to grow up instead of like terrified or sad or, you know. So that was kind of payday. I kind of felt like, my life is complete. Like, I'm good.
What input? Pack for good on your sons has this been? You've got two sons.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would think this family they grew up in has helped your sons.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. I think that we've modeled partnership really well. I mean, they know that I provide and that their dad provides and that we both take care of them. We both cook. My husband does all the grocery shopping. you know, we both do laundry. The kids do their own laundry. So we require a lot of our kids too.
That's great.
You know, their job is to support us and we support them. And, you know, we kind of all work together to keep the family life going.
And I would think as more of your kids get married, you'll see the fruits of your own marriage mm-hmm. and the principles you taught and wrestled with play out in their lives in a wonderful way. And they will have better skills and better understanding just because they've role modeled what they've seen in their own family. So I would guess you've got more paydays coming.
Yeah, I'm all up for it. But that was a big one because I really did worry about
my
girls.
Would you say for college age women that want to do what you are doing and don't quite know how it's going to work out, and there's a lot of negative voices
yeah.
says you can't do this and you're not good enough and it's a man's world and you know all those voices.
Yeah. Yep, I know.
If you just
voices.
Could talk to those women, those wonderful skilled women who want to do what, just feel impressed to do something that's a little out of the box.
Yeah.
What would you say to them?
I would say find a supportive spouse. So I've actually been researching this topic and that could be a whole different podcast. But what I found in some of the research I've been doing is that a supportive spouse really helps decrease what I call aspirational shame in Mormon women. So shame for having aspirations outside of home and family, and having a support system is really big. And so marry somebody who's supportive, who sees you as an equal, who sees your goals as valuable. Another theme is in the research is continue self-developing and kind of get comfortable in your own skin and with what your mission is, and work on self-awareness so you have the strength to do what you feel called to do. And then another theme is developing a personal relationship with God and seeking His approval for your path. And so those are a few suggestions that I have. Also, join Aspiring Mormon Women Facebook group. That's been a great resource. And one of their slogans is embrace your and. So I'm a woman and mother and therapist and business owner and songwriter and sister and, you know, singer and.
Wow.
So
that's cool.
Embrace your and. And so
that's
that,
really
I would
cool.
say that too. And then always advocate for yourself because it's not built in. It's not built into how families are the default mold. So advocate for yourself in your family.
What'd you say to women that aren't getting married and, you know, in their 25, 26, 27, coming to terms that I may not get married?
And
I've always sort of defined being complete, you know, married. And now I've got to navigate that road. I'm sure you've had many of those discussions. What would
I've
you say to
lot.
Those women?
I would say, Go full bore into your career, into your passions, into your hobbies. Like you, whether you're married or not, you're the boss of your happiness. You're in charge of your happiness. And, you know, embrace your life wherever you are, married or not. Embrace it and celebrate, you know, what is.
I love that. I love that. Any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
I just want to thank you for the chance to share some of my thoughts and for being interested in what I have to say. It's a gift.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Julie Hanks, for being on an episode of Listen, Learn, Love. You're a friend. I think your niece might be dating my son. We'll see how that plays out over the next period
of time. Word on the street, yes.
Word on the street. So we'll come back in another podcast and address that. But thank you for all you're doing, Dr. Hanks. And this podcast will help a lot of people. But you've just been following your life impressions to do what you're doing. And it's interesting because I look at what you've done with your practice, and it's not a practice where you're helping people.
Mm-hmm.
Think how many lives have been blessed between your therapeutic work and your 13 therapists that work there. And there's such a need for clinically trained people. I have a son that's going into social work and just got accepted to the University of Utah. And I'm grateful for everybody that goes into this field, I wish I had more experience in this field as a father and as a priesthood leader and just as a friend, to have more understanding of how to address some of these more complicated things. So thank you for your insights and joining us on another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler.